I am Jamshid Choksi, Professor of Iranian Studies at Indiana University, coming to you from the Bloomington campus on behalf of Real Clear World and Real Clear Politics.
And I'm Michael Rubin, coming to you from Washington, D.C., where I'm a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
Well, Michael, shall we start with discussing the cabinet developments in Iran?
I think we should. What happened yesterday is certainly an interesting fodder for discussion.
Oh, definitely. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. The way I read it was that Ahmadinejad pretty much got what he wanted. They took away two minor portfolio nominations, one in welfare, one in education, and they took away the energy nominee as well. But he did get defense, he got the foreign ministry, he got intelligence, oil, all the major portfolios, and also managed to get one woman in the cabinet. What's your read on the situation?
Well, I also find it extremely interesting. I would put some emphasis on the failure of the nominee for education to get there, because after all, the nominee for education was the one who had nominated Abbas Palizdar to join the auditing committee, which had caused such a scandal in the last cabinet, during the last government. But what really struck me is that it's only Hojat al-Islam Haydar Moslehi, the intelligence nominee, or now the intelligence minister, who has a clerical background, and his clerical background actually is much more in tune with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps units and so forth. If it weren't for the Supreme Leader's imposition of Moslehi on the cabinet picks, because it seems that he came from the Supreme Leader's direction, this could have been the first cabinet without a significant clerical component.
I think that's a very good point. I've always felt, particularly after the election now, that Ahmadinejad was trying to move his power base away from the clerics and more to the secular radicals, the Revolutionary Guard, the Basij, and this cabinet would seem to be working in that direction.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with you. And what also strikes me just about Ahmadinejad's picks during this government is it seems that he's really prizing loyalty perhaps above competence, and this was the problem with the last cabinet as well. Many of the people whom he's choosing are people that really did surround him during his short time as mayor of Tehran.
That's a very good point as well, and I wonder what that will mean then for Iran in terms of its economy, which is going to be the major internal crisis facing Ahmadinejad for his next 4 years. Because as we know, inflation is up, unemployment is up, revenues are down, and if the competence of the cabinet, the incompetence of the cabinet, does not lead to the economy picking up, then Ahmadinejad would have little hope of being re-elected. Not, of course, he has to sit out one round, one presidential election, but then he can come back for a third term. And so I wonder how that's going to play out. Any thoughts of yours?
Well, I just add to the list of problems you mentioned, there's also the housing liquidity issue, which is significant. And, you know, all politics are local, and politics certainly are domestic in this case, and the economy is tanking. What I would just add to what you say is with this increasing component of folks from the Revolutionary Guard, and since the September 2007 reorganization of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, when I'm talking about the Revolutionary Guard now, I'm also implying the incorporation of the Basij into it. We also have the expansion of the Khatam al-Anbiya, the Gorg, and the real growth of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard through much of the economy, which will make it difficult to have any significant reform. Remember, a couple presidents ago, President Rafsanjani, who was seen as a pragmatist, who was seen as a free marketeer to some extent on the Iranian spectrum, failed or was unable to push through any of the reforms which he had talked about. If he's unable to do it, and he had a real desire to do it, I really fear for the Iranian economy right now.
Yes, indeed. Rafsanjani failed, then Khatami failed after that over two terms, and we have seen it get worse now with Ahmadinejad's first term. The increasing involvement of the Revolutionary Guard in the economy, I think, may also come up this time around with the privatization that's going to occur of the telecommunications company, and then I believe there are 200-odd other companies scheduled to be privatized. All of which it would seem that the Revolutionary Guard is going to have a major stake in.
Well, this is true, but it seems, actually one of the biggest untold stories about Iran over the past couple years has been the privatization drive, which is often announced and seldom comes to fruition. But what I find most interesting here is what happened during the, back in 2005, I believe it was shortly before Ahmadinejad's election, where you had both the, and correct my date if I'm wrong, you had both the issue with the Imam Khomeini Airport and then the issue with Iran cell, where
yes,
the Islamic
indeed.
Revolutionary Guard stepped in. And we're going to see a real issue with regard to the third tender for the Iranian cell phone company, given the political protest last June, because the IRGC is going to scream security on everything, even when their real concern may not be security, but may be their own lining of the pockets. But just one other additional point to bring, and it comes to reform, and we will be talking about sanctions later. We don't need to shift the discussion there now. But one of the domestic issues inside Iran is that when people talk about the hardship, it seems that you have folks in the Revolutionary Guard, the so-called the principalists, the faction from which Ahmadinejad is derived, who say, what are you guys complaining about? When we were in our 20s, when we were in the best years of our life, we were down at the front facing mustard gas, facing trench warfare. So what do you have to complain about just because the price of apples are a little bit high?
What I see happening is sort of almost a divide between the generation that was off the revolution, the generation that went through the Iran-Iraq war, and then the large part of Iran's population, perhaps up to 50%, that post-dates the revolution and might very well be unwilling to accept the increasing engagement of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran's economy and also the increasing claims by the Revolutionary Guard that everything is security-related. It's almost, one gets the sense that for a large part of the Iranian population, the revolution is something they can no longer afford.
Well, this is actually interesting, and it leads us to one of the major issues going on in Iran right now, which is just in the last couple of days, the re-eruption of the political scandal with regard to the Islamic Azad University system, where you now, of course, Ahmadinejad has been targeting this, and as you know, the university system, it's a loose analogy, but it's almost like a huge nationwide community college system that was founded in the wake of the Islamic Revolution, where Ahmadinejad and his ideological cohorts are trying to seize control of it. It's seen as being a little bit more sympathetic to the more pragmatist camp surrounding Rafsanjani, and now there's been this dispute about whether ownership of it can be transferred into a waqf, into an Islamic endowment, in order to keep the government's hands off it. And this is a dispute which, just in the last couple of days in the Persian language newspapers, seems to be growing, with certain people saying what happened was illegal, what happened, the transfer of ownership, the transfer into a waqf was illegal. It will be interesting to see how this plays out, but what it does look like we're seeing is the social engineering aspect of the principalists, of Ahmadinejad and his camp, seem to recognize exactly what you're saying and the trend you're saying, and want to re-engineer society. And what I'm really afraid we're going to see is, in the second term, a real second cultural revolution inside the university system, which will, given the strength of Iranian academics, both in the sciences and traditionally in the humanities as well, it really would be a tragedy.
And I think that's certainly one danger. One can even expand it further, that if they succeed in doing so within the university system, they may then attempt, Ahmadinejad's supporters may attempt to push this through other aspects of society. The disputes of the Azad University, of course, as you know, go back quite a bit. It's linked very closely to the Rafsanjani family, the state has been trying on many occasions to impose its own chancellor, which the university system, the Azad University system, has tried to withstand. And your analogy of sort of being this community college system is very interesting, because it does have a very large number of campuses. In fact, my understanding is that the Azad University has been attempting to increase its own market share of the educational sector. Their target, I believe, is to get somewhere around 40% of everyone attending university in Iran to be going to some campus of Azad University. So a very powerful force, and a force that I think Ahmadinejad wants to make sure is not controlled by Rafsanjani, by Rafsanjani's son or by other pragmatists.
Well,
so
yeah.
I think we're seeing this sort of struggle, its move, you know, from that original political arena to these social arenas.
Well, I agree with you there, but then just the one additional trend, when it was originally founded, it was actually a brilliant tactical move on the part of the of Khomeini and his cohorts, because what it did was it removed a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds from the streets during the heyday of the revolution, when the running government, the new revolutionary government, was having a little bit of trouble producing and solving the problems. Now, if Ahmadinejad can, A, both increase the market share, and you're absolutely right about how part of this goes into the struggle with Rafsanjani's family, but if you can improve the market share at the same time, lower any academic standards the Islamic Azad University system has, it becomes a way for Ahmadinejad to try to remove the more uppity classes from the streets at a time when, as we've already discussed, the economy is failing. But
that's an interesting point.
I'm sorry?
No, that is a very interesting point, yes. To remove classes from the street when the economy is failing, to move, but it's also interesting, I think, to note that what can happen is this attempt to move yet another important intellectual sector away from the clerics to the secular radicals. And I think that's
indeed,
perhaps a great danger there.
Indeed. I mean, I fully agree. What one of my colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute, Ali Alfona, has talked about is how this slow, this expansion of the Revolutionary Guard and the principalists, if you will, is almost equivalent, he calls it, and somewhat controversially, a slow creeping military coup d'etat, which is just an interesting way to look at it. As ever since 1988, the Revolutionary Guard has been looking for a raison d'etre. And what this goes back to September 2007 with Muhammad Ali Jafari's ascendancy as the head of the Revolutionary Guard, we have the situation where it very much became much more inwardly focused, much more it viewed in the whole, I mean, Muhammad Ali Jafari, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard chief's biggest contribution to the theory when he was in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard think tank when he headed it, was that the greatest threat is going to be this velvet revolution, this struggle from within, rather than an external attack on the Islamic Republic.
And that certainly is the struggle that is emerging, and I think it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out between the various factions, both within the clerical institution, the activists, the quietists, but also between the pragmatists and the radicals in Ahmadinejad's own camp. Because when I look at his cabinet, on the one hand you see, the defense, intelligence, etc., tending to be, the more radical types. But I'd like to get your read as well on how we can sort of look at the foreign ministry aspect of it. Because it would seem that Ahmadinejad is attempting to, on the one hand, to maintain very tight internal control. On the other hand, perhaps to he's probably becoming more aware that at least a show of accommodation with the West may be necessary.
Well, what's interesting now that you bring up the foreign ministry is just the fact that we've had this purge just in the last couple of days of 40 ambassadors who are being recalled. Now, in the Iranian press, of course, they're saying that they do this every 3 years. I'm not really sure whether they actually do purge 40 ambassadors every 3 years, but it certainly seems that Ahmadinejad is trying to take a much firmer grip. Now, before we get to your question of what this means for Ahmadinejad's foreign policy and perhaps any accommodation, the other interesting thing is this relationship between Ahmadinejad and the supreme leader, and of course, it's all people that follow Iran and the Islamic Republic talk about, are the shifting power centers. Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, has always maintained his power by being sort of he was initially a compromise figure, and then he would balance the different power centers. With this election, with Ahmadinejad and the principalist attacks on all these other various power centers, it will be curious to see what sort of threat exists to the supreme leader. And what's interesting, it certainly seems like the supreme leader is off balance right now in terms of the power struggle, but it almost appears as if within the judiciary, he's building up a new power base to balance President Ahmadinejad and the principalists as Ahmadinejad successfully eviscerates so many other power centers.
And that's a very interesting point. If we sort of, you know, probe that a little more deeply, yes, Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, certainly lost a great deal of not just credibility, but also the notion that the supreme leader ultimately stays out of the mucky mucks of politics. And by getting involved right away in the election dispute, that sullied him. And then, of course, we've seen Ahmadinejad using that to his advantage to be able to move some power centers away. But I wonder whether, you know, whether ultimately it'll be the supreme leadership that will benefit from the changes in the judiciary, or whether what we are seeing is the judiciary, in a sense, taking off on its own, perhaps in conjunction with the Majlis of Parliament. You know, it's very interesting that you have two individuals, one charge of the judicial branch of government, the other in charge of the legislative branch. And I wonder whether the two brothers there, Ali and Sadiq Larijani, may sort of try to attempt to tag team against Ahmadinejad, particularly because at the end of this 4 years, Ahmadinejad is barred by the constitution from running again, at least for another, you know, for one term. And I'm sort of looking at, sort of trying to read the tea leaves. I wonder whether Ali Larijani, the Speaker of the Parliament, is the one shaping up to make a presidential bid 4 years from now.
I think it may be. And while Ahmadinejad and Ali Larijani certainly have conservative, very conservative politics in common, their personal dislike is legendary. And as you mentioned, Sadiq Larijani, yeah, the brother, is now the head of the judiciary. But the reason I brought up the judiciary wasn't just because of Sadiq Larijani. It was also because of because of Hojat al-Islam Mustafa Pour Mohammadi. Mustafa Pour Mohammed, the former interior minister who now heads the Supreme Audit Court, which, uh-huh, given all the discussions about financial irregularities, we didn't talk about all the election controversy with the $1 billion missing from the oil accounts, and also with Supreme Leader Khamenei pushing so hard for the intelligence minister, the former intelligence minister, Hojat al-Islam Ghulam Hussein Mohseni Ezehi, being part of the judiciary, that gives it a particular power base. And the reason why I brought up concern about the Supreme Leader and about the Supreme Leader's concern was, and I didn't see this really picked up too much in the Western press, when Ahmadinejad announced his cabinet picks, he announced his cabinet picks, on television at a press conference, before formally submitting them to Parliament.
Parliament did protest, as you are well aware.
Indeed, they did protest, so that's a slight of Parliament. But he also seemed to do it before he to announce the new government, before he formally got to start announcing the nominees, if you will. And this goes back into the Mashayi affair and so forth. Yeah. Before he was formally confirmed by the Supreme Leader, which certainly seems to be a slight of the Supreme Leader's power itself. That's why I think that perhaps Ahmadinejad is getting a little bit too big for his britches.
Well, and that's a good point. Yes, it's clear. You know, I think the miscalculation on the part of the Supreme Leader was coming out right away and declaring Ahmadinejad as the winner. As soon as that happened, we sort of see Ahmadinejad take off on his own. He's getting his cabinet ready. He's making announcements, and I think, yes, this is an attempt by the Supreme Leader perhaps to bring back some degree of balance. Perhaps the most hopeful aspect of it is that, irrespective of what the Supreme Leader does or doesn't do, that as we see the judiciary and the Majlis of Parliament exert themselves, I wonder whether in the long run we could actually end up seeing an attempt by those two branches of power to balance out the executive branch. Because if that were to happen, then that would certainly curb some of Ahmadinejad's aspirations. It would probably bring some degree of balance back to the political system of Iran. But of course, one can argue that maybe chaos or ongoing chaos is best in terms of ultimately destabilizing the revolution itself.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and as many of the viewers will know, you're not only an expert on the Islamic Republic, you're an expert on Iran and on pre-Islamic Iran as well. And I think we could both agree, as people who for a lengthy period of time have followed Iran, that this idea of shifting power centers and, if you will, duality is something that isn't just a fact or a phenomenon in the Islamic Republic, but there's something very Iranian about it.
Oh, yes.
That transcends
deeply
just
rooted,
recent
yes.
politics. Exactly.
Yes, very
and
deeply
so I do
rooted.
Think that's important to bring out. I fully agree.
Yeah,
with you.
Oh, I agree. Thank you for bringing it up, because the traditional Iranian metaphor for politics is sort of a table with four legs, one of them being the executive branch, one being the judiciary, one being the people, and the other being the bureaucracy. And so we had the Islamic Revolution replace the executive monarch essentially with another executive, a supreme leader. But it would be nice if, you know, in terms of sort of Iran's long-term prospects, if the outcome of the elections were to the trend continued to sort of have the supreme leader move more into the background, because the central question that comes up with all this after the election is why Iran needs a supreme leader at all 30 years after having gotten rid of a Shah.
Indeed. I can't agree with you more. That is the central question, and I think this is one of the reasons why, perhaps if we segue into the whole issue of the Shah trials, why the protests after the June 12th elections hit such a sensitive nerve, especially when some of the protesters, instead of transcended from protesting in favor of former Prime Minister Mir Hussein Mousavi, who many people believe rightly won the election, into chants of death to the dictator and so forth, which seemed to attack the very office of the supreme leader and the system of the Islamic Republic. I'm not in Iran, and I can't make any predictions about how wide that sentiment is, but it certainly seems to have touched a nerve in the Islamic Republic, and it seems to perhaps be behind the way that the Shah trials are being handled right now.
And Michael, you're focused on one of these very important and very sensitive nerves. Every time I've been in Iran, I've been struck by the notion of how that this has been an underlying question that people have had, that people have felt that they could not speak about quite openly. And this election and the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's coming out so very quickly, while there was still doubt about the election results, because he came out so quickly, it permitted individuals to make the point that, look, the Supreme Leader is nothing but a dictator. And so as a result, this leads us to, we can segue into the Shah trials, because you can see how, in a sense, the Shah trials have helped, in one way, initially undermine the Supreme Leader's office. On the other hand, it will, I think, in the long run, undermine the presidency of Iran as well.
I fully agree with you. And what's interesting when I read the transcripts of the multiple rounds of the Shah trials right now, there's no doubt in my mind, at least, and I doubt in yours either, that most of these conspiracies that are being presented as confessions in the Shah trial are absolutely ludicrous.
They're not just completely ludicrous, but as we have seen, even Iran's leadership has had to backpedal from it. You've had the supreme leader finally come out and say, no, it wasn't foreigners. But of course, at this point, they have beaten our confessions that it was foreigners out of many of these individuals.
Indeed, and that's an excellent point, too. But just by looking at the confessions and these elaborate plots that are developing and so forth, it does give an insight into the biggest fears and the biggest, if you will, Achilles heel of the Islamic Republic, and that's questions as to its religious legitimacy, specifically the legitimacy not only of the supreme leadership, but as you've written about in an article in World Politics Review, this older debate about the so-called Hujatiyya, which you may want to talk about, because it's one of those things that's not bantered about in the Western press, but it's extremely important, and it keeps rearing its head in Iranian politics every generation or so, in Islamic Republic politics,
of course,
every
Michael,
generation
and
or so.
Yeah, good point. With limited refining capacity, it imports about 40% of its refined petroleum products. And Ahmadinejad, knowing that this is coming, that these sanctions could very well be coming, has been moving to up Iran's internal refining capacity. So the way I see it, if we put these sanctions in place, it won't really hurt the ruling class. It won't really hurt the clergy. It won't really hurt the secular politicians. I don't believe it'll hurt the Revolutionary Guard. it will make them unpopular among the general populace. But I'm not quite. But that may last, let's say, until about 2012, when Iran is projected to have its own refining capacity well in place. So are we losing focus in terms of the sanctions? Should we be targeting the troublemakers as opposed to the general population?
Well, there's a few issues in what you brought up. One of them is the catch-22 in which not only the United States, but the West is caught up on because of the whole nature of the Iranian economy. On one hand, if you do sanction and a commodity like imported gasoline, what you're basically doing is, to some extent, empowering the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, which more or less has a monopoly over the significant smuggling. On the other
hand,
if you increase trade, because the Islamic Revolutionary Guard pours expansion into the economy, as well as the bunyads, these revolutionary foundations,
one is funding them,
many
yes,
of whom
of course
are headed by former Islamic Revolutionary Guardsmen, what you're also doing is trading almost exclusively with the hardliners rather than the ordinary Iranians. This was the whole reason why I'd argue that some of the critical dialogue, critical engagement that Europe had during the Khatami period failed. So you have that
mm-hmm.
issue. Now, certainly, one other issue has to do with some of the corruption and some of the smuggling. You're absolutely correct to say that because we've been telegraphing where we're going with the sanctions, where we, the international community, and the United States mm-hmm. once go, that Ahmadinejad has been trying to bypass that by boosting refinery capability and by also having these the gasoline rationing, if you will, which caused some problems a couple years ago. But mm-hmm. very few people have looked at what actually happened with the gasoline rationing. Iran imports, has to import because of its lack of refinery capability, about 40% of its gasoline
yes.
needs. Now,
correct.
When you had the way the rationing system worked is people were basically given a credit card and they would use that in order to have their allotment. If they had extra allotment, they could sell that ration to someone else, and in a way that brought the gasoline price up to market prices because people got more accustomed to A, they had a benefit they could sell, and B, if they needed to buy, mm-hmm. they would buy it at world market prices. The problem is, because of Ahmadinejad and his populism, literally another way of how he handed out cash, you would have the issue where he at first said, okay, the taxi drivers can have additional petroleum at the
mm-hmm.
subsidized prices, then the besiege and so
right.
forth, to the point where while gasoline imports declined to 25%, they then increased back up to 40% because of the lack of financial discipline. Iran's greatest economic enemy is itself and its
government.
Of course.
And not just its government, but shall we say these extra governmental apparatuses like the Revolutionary Guard
Indeed.
That is central to the smuggling of refined petroleum into Iran.
Indeed. Absolutely in agreement. Now, one of my criticisms with U.S. strategy all along has been our tendency to sequence strategies. You know, in military
yes.
academies and so forth, they have a paradigm which they call the dime model, which is every successful uh-huh. strategy should have a diplomatic and informational, military and an economic component. And just to be clear, when I say military, I don't mean bombing, because I also agree
no,
with
of course.
You
yeah.
that, I mean, the worst thing in the world would be bombing Iran, because, heck, the whole reason the revolution succeeded, Saddam Hussein was the greatest gift to the Islamic Revolution, because as it was eating itself and imploding and its direction was uncertain, Saddam Hussein invaded and Iranians rallied around the flag.
Just like we would, an attack right now would have them rally around. But
indeed,
even more than
indeed.
Rally around, I'm not sure whether at this point an attack would really be effective. You know, it may buy the West 5 or 10 years, but and this goes back to this whole issue of sanctions and the effectiveness of sanctions, Michael. Part of what the sanctions did was necessitate that Iran develop its own technology to overcome many of the sanctions that targeted them receiving centrifuges and other nuclear technology. So they seem to have developed an indigenous technology now, so in a sense may be better prepared to deal with any externally imposed hardship.
Well, there's a couple issues here. First of all, I'm not sure I agree with you on how indigenous a lot of the nuclear technology is. The Congressional Research Service, for example, has a report on North Korean-Pakistani trade. We then know about North Korean-Iranian trade, Pakistani-Iranian trade.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I don't mean that the technology was developed indigenously to begin with. I think what has happened is as we move to cut off those links,
indeed,
they are gradually finding ways to reproduce that technology locally.
I agree with you.
The Pakistani, I think that one of the greatest disasters was Khan Enterprises' disseminating of this nuclear technology all over the globe.
Indeed. I agree with you on that. Now, there's always a fine balance with sanctions in which when you target sanctions just to the elite, which I certainly support, then there tends not to be so much domestic pressure because it's not impacting ordinary people. If you do too much to the other extreme, you have a situation like what happened in Iraq where there was tremendous suffering. The key is to find a fine balance there.
Yes, of course.
Now, where I disagree with many other Iran analysts is that, while I agree with you, for example, that if there were any kinetic action, any bombing, Iranians would rally around the flag, some other people say that if there's more significant sanctions, that would also rally Iranians around the flag, and I haven't seen evidence of that in the past, that it does seem
I agree with you completely.
Iranians blame Ahmadinejad for the poor management.
Yes, of course, they blame, and in a sense, maybe the one sort of blanket sort of good, if you wish to, that has come out of the sanctions over all these decades is that the Iranians have come to realize that it is, you know, that this is not the West punishing the ordinary Iranian, that this is the West punishing the regime. The problem with it, of course, is that those sanctions are becoming less and less effective in trying to, shall we say, shape the behavior of the regime.
Now, there's a couple exceptions. There's actually one exception to this, which would seem to be some of the banking sanctions, which also don't impact ordinary people quite as much, but make it much more difficult for Iran. We talk a lot about I understand the importance of multilateral sanctions. Europe and the United States aren't, especially Europe, isn't going to give up a lot of business if China's then just going to come in and fill the void. The issue with the banking sanctions, especially if they apply to the central bank, is it effectively, it's the sanctions nuclear option. It effectively removes the Iranian financial system from the rest of the world, and that hasn't really been applied too much. But where I think as a long-term strategy, we need to focus much more attention. I identify the problem. Look, we both know that Iranian people are far more cosmopolitan and far more moderate than their government right now. And the question then becomes, how can we make the Iranian government much more accountable to the Iranian people? And I'd argue that, one of the trends which I tend to find the most intriguing is this whole trend of Mansour Sanlu, the Vahid bus drivers, and the development of independent trade unions. If you were to really have an expansion of support in some way for independent trade unions, you also have the same issue going down with the sugarcane workers down in Khuzestan.
Right.
That forces the government to be accountable to the people. And what I'm surprised at is that the Europeans and, frankly, also the United States government, with the Democrats in control, aren't able to focus much more on the development of independent trade unions, which can only have a benefit to the Iranian society and Iranian people.
Well, Michael, I think then that points to another issue that, shall we say, continuously is an issue that that U.S. administrations continuously stumble over, and that is we seem convinced that if we are seen meddling, that this is going to be counterproductive. And you know, the point you just made, that is, you know, finding ways to encourage, trade union activity, etc., may not be meddling, may actually be ultimately productive to Iran's economy and to Iran's society.
Well, there's a couple issues here. The United States often is, whether it's Republicans in control or Democrats, afraid of how their actions will be seen and whether their actions will have blowback, backfire. That's a meddling
all
issue.
The time.
But the issue is, in many ways, we're darned if we do, we're darned if we don't, because we're going to get accused of it anyway, so we might as well try to base our policy on what's right. An example of this, for example, the Democratization Fund was condemned, and we don't need to get into that right now.
I know.
But when we look at the show trial transcripts, a lot of people are being condemned for being engaged in track two dialogue. Does that mean that we're going to stop all Track 2 dialogue. I don't think that would be wise.
And that's a good point, Michael. I think, you know, I think part of the what you know, U.S. administrations need to realize is that, as you pointed out, we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. And so maybe we should do the right thing.
I fully agree with you. And the other issue, and this goes into the idea that when we have a diplomatic initiative underway like we do now, that any other issue, sanctions, support for trade unions, what have you, would interfere with that diplomatic movement, I think, is a little bit ahistorical. A lot of people who are advocates of engaged direct diplomacy with the Islamic Republic, unconditional diplomacy, will point out that the United States, after all, talked with China, the People's Republic of China, Nixon to China. We talked with the Soviet Union. But what they're leaving out is that at the same time we were leaving the door open to diplomatic engagement, we were also pursuing these other strategies, informational, military, and economic.
Oh, yes, and I agree with you fully. I think, you know, if you wish to use the word, let's engage Iran on multiple fronts, not all of them which will be diplomatic. Some of them may actually be what Iran would construe to be, what the Iranian regime would construe to be, non-engagement or punitive. But if we need to, I think we should. The question is, of course, how do we get get the EU, but also Russia and China to go ahead with this, because as you pointed out, the problem with getting people to go along with it is that the Europeans have often felt that if they completely move out of the Iranian banking sphere, then they will then the void will very quickly be filled by Eastern nations.
Well, it depends. I could recognize that fear if it had much more to do with industrial investment. If it has much more to do with banking, depending on how the banking sanctions are construed, even unilateral sanctions can have great impact. And I mean, for example, if you were to designate the Iranian Central Bank as being engaged in deceptive financial practices, what people at the Treasury, I'm not an economist, but what people at the Treasury Department tell me is that would make any bank doing business with an Iranian bank liable for any of that Iranian bank's deception, and that therefore, even if the Chinese at the United Nations Security Council don't agree to sanctions, in effect they would have to. But what I don't understand, shifting back to the whole issue of unilateral sanctions, is not all unilateral moves are necessarily bad. I don't see any reason why whoever occupies the Oval Office, be it George W. Bush or be it Barack Hussein Obama, shouldn't get up and name and shame companies like Siemens or perhaps Hewlett-Packard who are helping the Iranian government crack down on its own people. That doesn't take UN Security Council action. That just takes the bully pulpit of the Oval Office.
Off the Oval Office, good point. And, since you brought up Nokia and Siemens, we saw what happened there where very quickly those companies had to defend themselves and became, shall we say, accountable to the world for their actions.
Indeed.
And perhaps the same now will happen with HP, remains to be seen. But I think both those situations show us, you know, how Iran and also how Western companies tend to be very adept at moving around these sanctions, bypassing them. And the question then arises, is the United States administration willing to take the steps necessary to then, shall we say, extend the sanctions from Iran to those companies and banking institutions that have violated the sanctions?
Well, this is going to be the big question, which we're going to see
later. This is the big question, Michael.
Later this week after the G20, and what I'm afraid, and perhaps we can discuss the aftermath after September, 23rd or so?
Yes, granted, yeah. Because the question, Michael, is, now let us just, if I may say so, let us say, okay, and I have written saying that, yes, one way to sort of target the troublemakers in Iran is to, for example, sanctions against the Iranian Central Bank. And yes, we can sanction them, but then we have to go after every other banking institution that violates those sanctions. And do so by essentially banning those companies from doing business with the United States or in the United States.
Well, that's
and if we're
willing
to do that, that's effective. But are we going to?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the big issue, and this is what I'm afraid of as we approach September 23rd. When you're going to have diplomacy, whether it's sanctions or otherwise, one of the most issues, corrosive, that's the word I'm looking for, one of the most corrosive issues towards diplomacy is when you leave out a red line and then you violate it. It's much better not to give a red line than to lose the credibility of violating it. Now, after
and we have lost that with Iran a long time ago, unfortunately.
Barack Obama has a fresh chance, but if after September 23rd, after putting down this marker, there isn't any significant action, then we're going to be in a real conundrum. But maybe what we should do is meet again after September 23rd to talk about the aftermath of this, Jim.
To talk about what happens after that.
I mean, you and I...
Any predictions?
I'm not sure we're going to have any meaningful sanctions.
I agree with you.
But
I agree. I think that, you know, there will be a lot of sanctions on paper, but they will ultimately not be enforced. And... this leads to not just the Iranian administration, but the Iranian people also sort of looking at us and realizing that, you know, we talk the talk, but we don't really walk the walk.
You know, I'm a Washingtonian, and so I hate to give someone else last word, but I think I'm going to have to give you last word there. But what I would propose, since we could discuss this for 4 or 5 hours, I'm not sure anyone who's listening
to us... We should meet again.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So why don't we end this now? And we'll resume this in a couple weeks.
Excellent. And we'll see what happens in the power capitals of the world.
Okay, so I'm going to stop capture and then we'll talk later.
Thank you
so
much.
Bye-bye.